From the City of Angels near the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. By the way, well wishes to our Coast listener, Ron, from Missoula, Montana. He has undergone some intensive surgery. Heal up, Ronnie, heal up. Next hour, the failing war on drugs and your future. But here's what's happening. One of the most incredible stories on reincarnation I have ever heard. Listen to this one. A three-year-old boy in the Golan Heights region near the border of Syria and Israel said he was murdered with an axe in his previous life. He showed village elders where the murderer buried his body. And guess what? They found a man's skeleton there. He also showed the elders where the murder weapon was found. And upon digging, guess what? They indeed found an axe there. In his book, Children Who Have Lived Before Reincarnation Today, a German therapist, Trutz Hardo, tells this boy's story along with the other stories of children who seem to remember their past lives with verified accuracy. Now, the boy's story was witnessed by Dr. Eli Lush, who is best known for developing the medical system in Gaza as part of an Israeli government operation back in the 60s. Dr. Lush, who died in 2009, had recounted these astounding events to Hardo. The boy was of the Druze ethnic group, and in his culture, the existence of reincarnation is accepted as fact. His story, nonetheless, had the power to surprise his community. He was born with a long red birthmark on his head. The Druze believe that, some other cultures do too, that birthmarks are related to past life deaths. When the boy was old enough to talk, he told his family that he had been killed by a blow to the head with an axe. It is customary for elders to take a child at the age of three to the home of his previous life if he remembers it. The boy knew the village he was from, so they went there. When they arrived in the village, the boy remembered the name that he had in his past life. A village local said the man the boy claimed to be on the reincarnation had gone missing 4 years earlier. His friends and family thought that he may have strayed into hostile territory nearby, as sometimes happened. The boy also remembered the full name of his killer. When he confronted this man, the alleged killer's face turned white. Lash told this to Hardo, but he did not admit to the murder. The boy then said he could take the elders to where the body was buried. In that very spot, they did find the man's skeleton, as I mentioned, with a wound to the head that corresponded to the boy's birthmark. They also found the axe, the murder weapon. Faced with this evidence, the murderer admitted to the crime. Dr. Lash, the only non-Druze, was presented with this entire story. What an incredible story this is. I might try to get the author of that book, Children Who Have Lived Before, on the program. Amazing. Memorial Day weekend drivers will continue to take a hit as gasoline prices remain high. May 20th marked the 1,245th straight day that the national average for a gallon of regular gasoline costs more than $3 a gallon, according to the AAA. That's nearly 3.5 years above the $3 a gallon mark. 7 confirmed and 3 likely cases of E. coli infection linked to raw clover sprouts, reported by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. These patients all were in the Idaho or Washington area. Half of the people who have fallen ill have been hospitalized. Preliminary investigations indicate that the likely source of this outbreak are raw clover sprouts produced by Evergreen Fresh Sprouts of Idaho. Meanwhile, if you're in the Middle Eastern, hummus and the dip, products totaling about 14,800 pounds, are being voluntarily recalled by a company called Lancel amid concerns about possible bacterial contamination there. Bad news for HP, Hewlett-Packard. It will cut an additional 11,000 to 16,000 jobs after previously revealing plans for 34,000 layoffs. Not good. And listen to this one. A House committee has approved a proposal that would end door-to-door mail delivery for millions of Americans, maybe you, in favor of communal or curbside boxes. The House Oversight and Government Reform Committee approved the measure The bill would direct the U.S. Postal Service to convert 15 million addresses over the next decade to the less costly but also less convenient delivery method. Howard Bloom, of course, our dear friend, author of The Genius of the Beast. Howard, has the internet done in the Postal Service?
This move may not even be necessary. The fact is that the U.S. Postal Service does not receive any government money. It doesn't receive taxpayer money. It operates entirely on the money that it makes from selling you stamps and selling you shipping. The fact is that the government laid a heavy burden on the U.S. Post Office in 2006 and required that the Post Office pre-fund, that is, lay the money aside in advance, its retirement health benefits. And ever since then, the Post Office has been struggling with losses. Well, despite that fact, despite this extraordinary burden that is not required of most businesses, the Post Office has been decreasing its losses. It lost almost $16 billion in 2012. Last year, in 2013, it only lost $5 billion. That's mighty progress moving forward. So there is no reason that 15 million people would need to be removed from door-to-door delivery. And in fact, if the government is in fact not supplying the Post Office with any money, how dare it lay these additional burdens down, not only on the Post Office, but on people like you and me who rely on Post Office deliveries.
Times are changing, though, Howard. I really think, you know, a lot of people are paying their bills online now. They used to just slap a stamp on that, write a check, and off it would go. Those days are gone.
Those days are gone, and once upon a time, postmen were known for basically delivering a sense of community. They knew everybody in the neighborhood. There were housewives who were isolated at home all day long. They said hello to those people. They said hello to people who were invalids,
everybody
people
knew.
Who were elderly. But those days are gone, too, because today, with the email, you have community as long as you have a laptop or as long as you have a smartphone.
I remember the days where my parents used to leave Christmas presents in the mailbox for the postal person.
It was terrific, and I know in my neighborhood, which is in Park Slope in Brooklyn, we scarcely even know our letter carriers anymore.
Well, nowadays, if you do that, somebody would be stealing from your mailbox. Unbelievable. Howard, thanks. Stay in touch with us, okay?
Okay.
Howard Bloom. Well, in my days in school, biology class, science class, we used to call them Drosophila, fruit flies. Well, guess what? Fruit flies think before they act, according to a study. How in the heck did they find this out? Researchers from the University of Oxford, the neuroscientists show that the fruit flies take longer to make more difficult decisions. They actually think about things before they act. This weekend, the Earth will pass through a stream of debris from a comet. And if forecasters are correct, the encounter could produce an outburst of bright meteors numbering more than 200 per hour. Who better than to ask? Stephen Cates, Dr. Sky. What a display, Stephen.
Well, George, we're sitting on the eve of what might be, for the Coast audience, a spectacular weekend of meteors, or, on the opposite side, the corollary, maybe a complete dud, but here's the optimism. George, back in 2012, astronomers noticed one bright fireball from this so-called meteor shower that we're calling the Camelopo Pardalids from the northern constellation. This constellation, a giraffe in the sky, so when you're looking, look directly to the North Star. But what they saw one super bright fireball, and it actually tracked to where all this debris would be, and they didn't have any publicity. So now we have all the publicity. So sky watchers, look to the North Star in the sky all night, as long as you have clear skies. And George, the best rates, we're hearing this. If we're going to see anything good, get a load of this. Maybe upwards of 200 or more meteors per hour from 2 a.m. Eastern time
wow.
to 4 a.m. But here's a Coast exclusive. I'm suggesting that if we are seeing a lot of meteors, for those of you that have the waning crescent moon rising, take a look at it, because that might be where all the action is, George. In telescopes, people may be seeing actual meteors impacting the moon in the dark region.
Oh, that's exciting.
And it's amazing. So we'll keep you posted. And good luck, folks. More info at drsky.com and always aviation at photorecon.net.
And I hear rumors I may see you this weekend at Scottsdale.
George, I am looking forward to that and cannot wait. This will be a wonderful encounter.
All right, my friend. Be well.
You.
Dr. Sky, you want to come out there? There's information at coasttocoastam.com under my calendar at our next event. Astronomers in America have told Congress that the search for extraterrestrial life is plausible, warrants scientific inquiry. One of those, Seth Shostak of the SETI Research Center at the University of California, Berkeley, presented evidence to the House committee to secure further funding to find alien life out there in outer space. In a moment, Seth tells us what else happened on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie, and we have Seth Shostak from SETI for the rest of this hour. He's back from Congress, of course, where he was trying to get them to understand that the search for extraterrestrial intelligence is necessary. Seth, always a pleasure. How successful do you think you were?
Well, George, that's hard to say, but the feedback that I've heard so far has been positive, and I have to say the experience was positive. So in that sense, I guess we've done what we went to do.
Well, and I hope they do something, because this has been a project that has been so near and dear to your heart and everybody who listens to this program, these possibilities of finding life out there, whether it's through your technology or technology you may develop in the future. What was it like? Tell me, when you made your presentation, tell me about those eyes and ears of Congress.
Yeah, well, needless to say, I was a little bit anxious myself. There were two of us testifying, Dan Wertheimer from the University of California at Berkeley's SETI project, and myself, and I'm from the SETI Institute, as you know.
Mm-hmm.
So both of us were there. We had to give a little bit of a five-minute presentation at the start of the proceedings, and then after that, it was just Q&A for about an hour, something like that. And the Congress members that are members of this committee, it's the House Science, Space, and Technology Committee, were, of course, allowed to come in, were encouraged to come in and listen to the testimony, ask their questions. Now, you know, at Congress, there's always competition for your time. And
money.
It was unclear whether there were going to be many people there. But it was a pretty good crowd, and the audience was huge.
What kind of questions did they ask you, Seth?
Well, we had submitted written testimony, so those who took the time to read that would have had the background on what we were talking about.
Right.
But they were interested in understanding, you know, well, what is the motivation for this? Why do you think they're out there, basically, right? And so that story is one about mostly these days finding so many habitats, like this story from 3 or 4 weeks ago, Kepler-186f, you know, the first Earth-sized planet found that, you know, has the right temperature range to perhaps have liquid oceans and atmospheres, the first cousin of Earth, if you will. So we sort of set the stage by telling them about that, and then I told them about radio SETI. Dan Wertheimer told them about optical SETI, looking for flashing lights. So we told them how we're doing it. And then the further questioning was mostly about, you know, the practicalities and any other things that came to their minds. Nice.
Did they seem that they were interested in this subject matter?
Yes, they did. They did. I was looking at them the entire time to make sure that they were paying attention.
Yeah.
Because I didn't know whether they would. They've got other things to think about. Needless to say, their eyes were pretty much riveted on us the entire time. I have to say that they were very interested. These are not stupid people. You can think whatever you want of politicians, but they're not stupid. And they asked, for the most part, very intelligent questions. Some questions were slightly more frivolous, if you will. But I was impressed. Honestly, I was.
Seth, in terms of money, I think, as we've talked over the years, you're privately funded now, right? Primarily?
That's right.
Okay.
Yes.
And did NASA originally fund SETI in the beginning?
Well, there certainly was a NASA SETI project. I mean, the first SETI experiment, the one done by Frank Drake in 1960, where you spent a couple of weeks aiming an antenna in West Virginia at a couple of nearby stars, you know, he just sort of did that. He was an astronomer at the observatory. It was just a little project. He spent very little money on it, a couple of $1,000s, I think. And for a long time, that was sort of the way it was being done. But then in the 1970s, a fellow at the NASA Ames Research Center, a guy by the name of John Billingham, he was actually a British physician, in fact. But he got very interested in this, and he convinced NASA to start building some equipment. So when I joined the SETI Institute, and that was about 1990, it was a NASA program. It was running at a few million dollars a year, at most $5 or $10 million a year, which today sounds like a lot of money to us. At the time, we didn't think it was very much money, but yeah, whatever. And so it was a NASA program, and it had just finished building all the equipment. This was 1992. All the equipment was ready to go. The switch was ready to be flipped, and we were going to start to try and tune in on ET when the whole project was canceled by a congressman from Nevada.
So this would be new money if they decided to fund you, right?
Yes, it would be. I mean, if they decided that they wanted to put this back in as a structural part of NASA, I mean, I suggested to them that it's kind of a punchline to a lot of the NASA effort. NASA is interested in life in space, okay? And, you know, they have some very sophisticated programs to look for, you know, life on Mars in case it's still there or was there. Life in the outer solar system, Enceladus, Europa, these are all names that are familiar to a lot of listeners, places where there might be life, even today. And it seems to me to only make sense that in addition to all that, you have one small little project or a couple of small little projects to look for the kind of life that could hold up its side of the conversation, intelligent life.
Was there a set amount that you asked for in terms of budgetary money?
We did not ask for any money. We did not make a direct pitch. The idea here was to inform them. That's the purpose of the congressional testimony, and not to say, hey, you guys give us this money. But what we did tell them is how much money is being spent on these projects these days, and of course it's very small. And one point that came up several times, and this is something that a lot of people actually don't know, the total number of people in the world who do SETI for a living is, you know, fewer than work at my local car wash.
That's true.
It's a very small number of people. So, you know, I think that message gives them some idea of how much money we're talking about.
How did you leave it with them? What happens next?
Well, what happens next depends on the committee. The committee is headed by Representative Lamar Smith. He's a congressman from Texas, and I can assure you, he is very interested in this. He has lots of books on this subject. He has actually even come to the observatory occasionally when we've been, you know, doing our experiments. He came down to Puerto Rico, you know, the big antenna down there.
Arecibo.
So he's been there. He is keen on this. He wanted to be an astronomer when he was younger. Then he got to college and decided, well, you know, there was too much math for him. So he became a lawyer, I guess. But in any case, he is personally very keen. But, you know, the chairman doesn't get to say this is what's going to happen. He can only be, if you will, a cheerleader for the project. So if the committee decides they want to take action, well, they can take action.
When I was doing my local St. Louis Nighthawk show, Seth, I think you and I talked. You were down at Arecibo at the time when I tracked you down. That probably would have been around 97, 98. Would you have been down there right around then?
Yes, we were.
Yeah.
We were indeed.
I remember that. We had a great conversation, and God, it was just exciting. Well, I hope that works. I hope we get funded for SETI. Now, God forbid, if they don't fund, are you still going to be okay?
Well, you know, we are running now on private donations.
Right.
And you know how tough that is in today's economy, probably in any economy, to be honest, George. It's tough. We're you know, people send us some money, but it costs, you know, let's face it, if you've got a team of 5 or 10 people and you got to run the observatory, I mean, it costs you $1 million or $2 million a year.
Just to
now, in the bigger scheme of things, that's not an enormous amount of money, but for individuals, that is. So it's hard to raise that money, but we have managed to keep going, albeit at a fairly low level. It's on the down low, and it's hard to do the experiment on the down low. You need a certain critical mass of manpower to do it. And so I'm optimistic, but I'm just the kind of guy who is optimistic. I don't know.
Well, I'm glad Paul Allen from Microsoft fame was able to make his donation to give you those Paul Allen array of telescopes.
Yes, Paul Allen indeed put in some money so that we could get this telescope built in Northern California. It's about 300 miles north of San Francisco is where the Allen Telescope Array is. But the problem with it is that it's you know, only the first part of it got built. There are 42 antennas. The design goal was 350.
That's right.
And, you know, so we still need the money to you know, make that a bigger instrument, a much more sensitive instrument. We are using it the way it is. So, you know, we're going with what we got. But what you really want is more antennas. That sounds, you know, kind of self-serving, but it's just a fact that if you want to find E.T., you've got to mount a real effort. It's sort of like discovering Antarctica.
Yeah, you've got to listen. Seth, we're going to take some phone calls with you when we come right back. The SETI astronomers telling Congress there's alien life out there. And welcome back to Coast. Seth Shostak with us. SETI, one of his books, Confessions of an Alien Hunter, and we'll get your calls in just a second. Seth, what do you think? What's the gut tell you? What's out there in the universe?
I think there's a lot out there, George. That was a point we made. We tried to impress upon the Congress people that, hey, look, our galaxy, maybe a trillion planets, and the latest results suggest that maybe one in five has a planet like the Earth. So, hey, that's 200 billion Earths in our galaxy, you know, plus or minus a few. And, of course, there are 150 billion other galaxies we can see. So, you know, there's going to be a lot of stuff. And I'm sure it's far beyond most of our imagination.
Do you think they're all out there looking, questing, just like we are right now, to find other sources of life?
Well, I suspect that a lot of them are. I mean, it's hard to imagine that that wouldn't occur to just about any intelligent species. I mean, you know, certainly humans have thought about it for a long time. The Greeks wrote about it. But I'm sure the cavemen, when they stepped out of their caves at night and looked up and saw the stars, and they probably didn't know what the stars were, but they couldn't have helped but think occasionally, you know, what do you think, Zork? Is there somebody up there looking back this way? So, you know, it just seems to me a very obvious question once you have a brain.
Now, you don't believe, though, that we have been visited. I don't, as we've talked over the years, you say there's that possibility, you haven't ruled that out, but you really don't believe we've been visited. How come?
Well, I don't, because the evidence just doesn't seem to be very convincing to me, that's all. And I hear from a lot of people. I get accused sometimes of not looking deeply into the evidence, and, you know, that's true. I don't have the time to go investigate some of these cases the way other people do. Some people investigate them and decide that they're convinced that we're being visited, and other people investigate them and decide, no, we're not being visited. But I leave that to them. That's their expertise. I don't expect them to do SETI research either. So, but the evidence that has been presented and that's freely available just doesn't strike me as being very convincing. And I might say that's true for, you know, most of my colleagues, too, if not all of my colleagues.
Seth, take us through a SETI moment in the event we ever get this signal. How will it come in? What will it be like?
Well, it's a little hard to say, but on the other hand, we have had some false alarms, and so they give you some insight as to what would happen. To begin with, of course, it's going to be totally unexpected. You know, these things never come in when you're expecting them, mainly because you're never expecting them. But, you know, you're just looking at the data, and suddenly there's a signal that, you know, comes in. Well, you get signals all the time. That doesn't surprise you. But this one doesn't go away. When the computers do the automatic tests to see, is this really E.T., or is this just some sort of interference because of a, you know, satellite passing overhead?
Mm-hmm.
And so it would just slowly build with time. And at some point, it would get to a threshold where some of the scientists would say, you know, this is really interesting. I'm gonna send some emails to some of my buddies that were following a really interesting signal. And that'll happen. We know that'll happen because we've seen it happen. And when it happens, and suddenly, you know, everybody knows about it because it's on Twitter and whatever, people's blogs, the media start calling up. The chances are, after all that it'll turn out to be, you know, just interference, and we'll have to tell everybody, sorry, folks, false alarm. That's not a good scenario. But the only alternative to that is to try and keep things secret. And that's impossible to do, really. It's impossible. And not a good idea, anyhow. People believe that we're keeping secrets. So it's going to be very messy. It's going to be very, very messy. It isn't going to be like in the movies where suddenly we make a big announcement and there's a press conference
right,
and the president calls up and all that
stuff. Jodie Foster comes running in, right?
It would be nice. It would be great, but probably not.
So will it be voice or data?
Well, all we'll know is that at a certain spot on the dial, you know, there's just an excess of radio energy. Okay, so all we know is that their on-the-air sign is illuminated. Okay, we won't know, what the message is. That requires a different set of equipment. That's a much harder problem, actually.
And
it's much easier to just find that they're on the air first.
And it could be from a million years ago, right?
Yeah, it could be. Yeah, then they'd have to be in another galaxy. So I think that's a little unlikely because the signals get kind of weak when you're a million light years away. But the signal probably is from a couple of hundred years ago. That's very likely, at least tens of years ago, but more likely a few hundred, maybe even a thousand years ago. But hey, you know, the Big Bang was 13 billion years ago. There's been plenty of time.
It sure has been. Let's go to the phones. First-time caller, Cisco in Toledo, Ohio, is with us. Welcome to the program, Cisco. Go ahead.
Hi, so I'm a long-time listener, first-time caller.
Oh, thank you.
I have seen personally two UFO sightings. And one was in 94 and coming out of Detroit Airport. And when the news finally broke of this, they had a UFO show on. Those two pilots both were reporting the same sighting I was watching. And one said it was about 400 yards long and it was flashing lights and it was going in like a circle coming out of a cloud. And that's exactly what I was watching. And then the last summer, a ball bearing type, looked like a drone, but it had no wings or whatsoever. It was flying straight through at high speed, and I saw it before I get my camera out. It was gone. But in my opinion, we are an experiment because they haven't been here and destroyed any of us. And I think they've put every one of a species on Earth and watch us because we're the only ones in the galaxy, it seems. And I think we're an experiment. Look at ants. Look at whales. It's just one species of everything. That's my opinion.
Seth, give me your take on people seeing objects. They're obviously seeing something. The big question is, what are they seeing?
Well, exactly, George. And indeed, I get people calling me up and telling me things that very similar to what Cisco just described, actually, about things they've seen, and they move very fast, and they're much too big, and they can't be aircraft, and so forth. And the first thing that struck me is that Cisco saw this, you know, in the vicinity of an airport. And it turns out there are things in the skies near airports. So that's right away something that, you know, is a little bit suspicious. Now he says it's 400 yards long, and no airplane is 400 yards long. But on the other hand, the only way you can know how big it is to know how far away it is. Right, and then measure the angular size. Those are two things that most people haven't thought about a little bit. They just look at it and they say, oh, I think I know how big that is. So, you know, you actually need to do measurements. Look, I do hear from people all the time, and they're not making things up. They've seen things, but it's just as you say, if you're going to make the claim that, doggone, what I've seen is actually a craft from another star system, well, then give me the really good video, or get a piece of the craft, or do something, or have satellites, and there are thousands of satellites, make photos of it from orbit. That would be a little more convincing.
Let's go to Skip in Warren, Ohio. Welcome to the program. Skip, you're up with us.
Hey, how you doing, George?
Good. Thank you.
Listen, there's evidence, and it was delivered by a man named Dr. David Duncan. Everybody knows him as Carl Sagan. In the book, Pale Blue Dot, as one of his science books, not a science fiction book. And he said that SETI has received 11 signals out of the hundreds of thousands that they've looked at. And all these 11 signals lack only one criteria for being a signal for another planet, and it's all the same criteria that they didn't repeat. But then again, when we sent out our signal at Arecibo, we didn't repeat it either.
All right, I'll get your take on that. Seth, what did Carl Sagan have to say about SETI?
Yeah, well, Skip's right. And it wasn't just 11, by the way. In the early days, there were lots and lots of signals that were seen only once. Maybe the most famous one that some listeners will have heard of is the celebrated WOW signal. Since you're getting a lot of callers from Ohio, I'll mention the WOW signal because that was picked up at Ohio State University there in Columbus. And it was a big, strong signal, and it had the right characteristics to be what we're looking for, but it was seen once. And then the telescope automatically looked a second time just a little over a minute later and didn't see it. Okay, so what can you say? You saw it only once. And that, by the way, is true, not just 11 signals, there were many more. And all you can say is, we saw it once. Maybe it was ET, maybe it was interference, but if you don't see it again, unfortunately, you know, it's just not science to claim that you found E.T. You may have, but there's no proof. And so you're not going to, you know, it's like it's a criminal trial. The evidence is just not good enough. And so all you can do is say, you know, we'll have to throw up our hands on this one. So it's not a discovery.
Now, who is David Duncan?
I don't know who David Duncan is. There's a Doug Duncan, but I don't know that that's the same guy. So David Duncan, I don't know.
He kind of alluded that Carl Sagan changed his name. I don't think he did. I think he was born.
No, he didn't change his name.
He was born Carl Sagan, wasn't he?
He was.
Gary in Modesto, California, west of the Rockies. Hey, Gary, thank you for calling.
Hello, yes.
Hi there.
How are you?
Good.
Good. I have a story that, about 3 years ago, August, a friend and I were scouting for a hunt in eastern California, north of Bodie, California, ghost town out there. But anyway, first evening that we were there, we started noticing lights. We thought it was lightning at a time. Now, this was a massive, massive display, and we're miles from anywhere. And we soon discovered it wasn't lightning that was striking. That we began to look up. There was clouds earlier in the day, but anyway, wasn't lightning. There's no thunder, anything like this. And at dusk time, we started seeing these lights. And we're talking probably 25 miles to the left to 25 miles to the right and out in front of us. It's just a huge, huge area in eastern California. And these lights, laser-like lights, just time and time again. It started at dusk, and we stayed there. We didn't know if we should leave or not. But anyway, we watched this for over 3 hours. It was close to 1 o'clock when we finally just said, hey, we're going to sleep. Went up my sleeping bag and went. But we had these laser lights that would they were just going off everywhere. It wasn't, like I said, there was no noise. They were very bright. And the other peculiar thing that would happen is that as this display was going on, there would be clusters of star-like lights that would just come on and then just go off. And like I said, you could look to your left. The horizon is just very vast out there. And you didn't have to wonder if I was going to look on this, looking at the right spot. They were hundreds and hundreds of episodes. And we even had, there was a little mountain right in front of us. And three times from the backside of where we were, there were these lights that would just march up. And we actually saw the light hit on top of a mountain. It was probably a mile away from us, half a mile to a mile. And we could see it explode on top of the mountain.
I know it's dramatic.
Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say what you were going to say. We really just don't know what these are.
Yeah, I would ask you this, Gary.
Go ahead.
What's that?
Well, Gary, what I would ask you is this. I mean, what about all this made you think that this had anything to do with extraterrestrials? What aspect of it tied it for you to extraterrestrials?
Well, it came from the heavens. You could see, the clusters of lights that would come on and off.
Clearly they were coming down.
I know a friend that has done a lot of involved with the military, and I talked to him about it, and he said, you know, it would be we would only do that on a secure area. It happened right in front of us.
Well, let me just jump in here, okay? What I'm hearing you say is that, okay, the thing that convinced you that it was extraterrestrial were two things. One, it was in the sky rather than on the ground, although, you know, it could have been on the ground just over the horizon. And the second thing is you didn't know what it was.
It was so massive. Like I said, we could watch.
Right, exactly. Okay, I got that. I guess all I'm saying is this, Gary. I don't know what it was either. I mean, I'd be upfront about that. But on the other hand, all you really know is you saw some phenomena there that you don't know what they were. And so that the error in logic is to say, I don't know what that was. So it must have been extraterrestrial. See, that's an argument from ignorance in the sense that you don't know what it is, so you say it must be that. Okay, and that, you know, that isn't going to fly, if you will. It won't fly with scientists because they say, well, you haven't tied it to extraterrestrials. It could be, you know, atmospheric phenomena. It could be, you know, probably a laundry list of things it could be. But we don't know what it was. It's just incorrect to say, therefore, it's extraterrestrial.
Will those ETs that are out there know that we're sending them signals?
Well, if they're close enough. If they're close enough, I think during the testimony, Dan Wertheimer said that if they're within, you know, some of the nearer stars, they could be watching The Simpsons now. It's kind of statistically unlikely they're that close. But, you know, our first television signals began shortly after the war. We had radar during the war. We had FM radio just right before the war. All those signals have been going out into space. So how long has it been since the war? 75 years or thereabouts. So those signals are 75 light years out. Anybody within that distance, if they have a big enough antenna, and it doesn't require, you know, incredibly huge antenna, they could pick those up. And so, yes, they could know about us if they're that close. But that is pretty darn close.
They're probably picking up this show going, oh, those Earthlings are different.
The only thing is that Coast to Coast is AM. If it were Coast to Coast FM, they would pick it up. AM doesn't make it.
We're on some FM stations now, so who knows?
Oh, well, then in that case, they could be listening.
Let's go to Bill, the amateur astronomer from West Hartford, Connecticut. Go ahead, Billy.
Yes, hi, Seth. Hi. I'll ask two questions real quick, and then listen. Take the answer off the air. Question is about the Kepler mission. You mentioned Kepler 186f. Question number one: NASA just approved 2 days ago K2, the new Kepler mission that will look. I think it's on the ecliptic or the plane of the solar system. You'll tell me in a second if I'm correct, as opposed to looking between the constellations Cygnus and Lyra as it did for 3.5 to 4 years. What new kind of stars or close stars or interesting stars will K2 be able to look at? And question number two is, in the data that's already there from the original Kepler mission, when will you mention finding Earth's cousin already? When will we find Earth's twin, an Earth-sized planet orbiting a sunlight star about 365 days to orbit the star?
Yeah, well, good questions. Let me just take the second one first, Bill, and that is, you know, when will we find more cousins of Earth? And you can talk to the Kepler folks. A lot of them work at the SETI Institute, as a matter of fact, including Elisa Quintana, who was the one who found Kepler 186f. And, you know, they're fully expecting that when they, you know, comb through the remaining Kepler data before it lost that second third reaction wheel, I guess it's the second one it lost, but anyhow, you know, that they will find some of these things. So I would say probably within a year you can expect this to happen. I'll bet you a cup of coffee on that one. As far as what's Kepler going to do now, because it doesn't have these, you know, essentially gyroscopes in it to allow it to very accurately point at the stars it was looking at, they've come up with a very clever trick where they use the radiation pressure from the sun, if you will, the pressure that the sunlight exerts on the spacecraft to point it in one direction, and then they use the other two wheels for the other two directions. And that means it can only look in the ecliptic. It can only look, as you say, in the plane of the solar system. So there are all sorts of things it's going to look at. It isn't going to be able to find planets in the same way it did before, but it will be able to study other astronomically interesting stuff. So Kepler has changed careers, I guess you could say.
Seth, my friend, always a pleasure having you on the program. Let's keep in touch. Good luck. Let's hope that if Congress spends money, they spend it on SETI. I'll be back in a moment with the judge on Coast to Coast AM.